going to talk about characters today because we are in our series of Esther, and we started last week, and if you remember, whether you were here or not, what we talked about was that we're going to go through Esther looking at the elements of the story rather than just truck through verse by verse, chapter by chapter. So what we did last week was look at the setting. Today we're going to look at the characters. And each week when we look at the elements of the story, we're going to look at the element itself, where God is in that element, and then where God is in that element of your story, because we can all see our lives kind of like a story. So last week was the setting and theme. So really quick, before we jump into the characters, let's recap quickly what we talked about last week. First off, big thing with the book of Esther, God is never mentioned. God doesn't speak, God is not mentioned, which kind of gives us our theme of the story, which is God's silence is not God's absence. And that's because God is all over this book, but he doesn't speak and nobody talks to him, but he's all over this book. So that's kind of our theme. God's presence or God's silence is not his absence. So he's present. So to set up the scene, what we did last week, we talked about we are in the Persian Empire in Susa. Mostly takes place at the king's palace, King Xerxes, who we're going to meet a little bit more pretty soon. And it starts off with him throwing this monster party scene where he's trying to impress all of his friends and the nobles and the officials. He just wants to look awesome. And at the end, he asks his queen, Queen Vashti, to come out and basically parade herself as a showpiece in front of him and all of his drunken friends, and she refuses. So he issues an edict or a decree or a new law that would say Vashti can never again be in my presence, so she's banished, and all the wives in Susa and all the provinces I rule must respect their husbands. So that's kind of where we are. It sets us up because we need a new queen, and we're going to meet our new queen today. But first, we're going to look at some other characters. So there's four, I think, main characters that really give us this story, and I think it's important to meet them a little bit before we dig into the plot starting next week to really kind of know who they are and what they're about. So here's how we're going to look at the characters. I'm going to have a little bit of fun because if you've heard me talk before, I talk sports and food and pop culture references. We're going to do more of that. So with each character, I'm going to give you a Disney character that I think that character is like, because I have a 5 and now 2-year-old, so I'm immersed in Disney films. And at the end, I'm going to give you a real-life actor or actress that I would cast in that role if Hometown was producing the movie of Esther. Budget's not an option. Availability, no issues. It's all meant to be fun. I don't know that any of these people are Christians at all, but it's meant to be fun. Who would I cast in these roles? So that is what we're going to look at today. Big thing, though, today with the characters is this. The character of God is shown in the characters of your story. So the character of God is shown in the characters of your story. We're going to see the character of God in these characters. Then you can take a chance to look at where is the character of God in the character of your own story. So let's meet some characters. Let's talk about good old King Xerxes. He reminds me of Scar from The Lion King. All right, now when Scar becomes king. All right, so Xerxes is kind of supporting cast guy. All right, and we'll figure out why he's like Scar a little bit. So let's read about Xerxes. We're going to be in the book of Esther. You can follow along on the screen. That's going to be the easiest way because I'm going to jump around a little bit to get us some info about these characters. So Esther, chapter 1, verses 1 through 3, tells us a little bit about Xerxes. And it says, "This is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present." That's the party we were talking about last week. So what do we learn about Xerxes? He loves to show off, loves to have power, and he loves control. He shows off. This party is filled with the best linens, the fancy golden goblets, open bar, all the nines. That's what this party was like. And he loves to have power and control. We see he ruled 127 provinces. He's also known as a guy that by land and sea attacked Greece, setting off a 2-year war. All right, he loved power, wanted control. What else? Esther chapter 1, verses 19 through 20 says, "Therefore, if it pleases the king," this is one of his advisors talking to him, "let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. This is him being described as, I read it this way, hubris and wanton cruelty. Basically, he's careless, he's reckless, and he has absolutely no regard for his actions. Hubris is arrogance. He just wants everything. He thinks he can do anything he wants. He's reckless. He never thinks about the ramifications of this edict. He doesn't know what's this going to do to Vashti. What's this going to mean for the wives or anybody in the provinces he rules? He's only thinking about the fact that he looks really bad in front of all his people because his wife will not come out after he demanded that she come out. So this is like Scar and the Lion King. He brought in the hyenas to the Pride Lands, right? He didn't care about anybody else there, and they lost all their food, right? He only cared about himself and having power. That's what Xerxes does, only cares about himself and the power and control and showing off. So to recap, Xerxes shows off, loves power, loves control, and no regard for anybody else whatsoever. So if I'm going to cast this role, who am I putting in the role, Sam? Al Pacino. Al Pacino is going to play King Xerxes in my film. Old Al Pacino, not like Scarface Pacino, but older Pacino. He just seems like this gruff, I don't care about anything, I'm awesome kind of guy. So I would cast Pacino. I love old like gangster and mob movies too. So like Pacino, De Niro, and all those guys. So that is Xerxes. All right, now let's take a look at our next character. This is our guy, Haman. Sam, who does Haman remind me of? Jafar from Aladdin. Jafar from Aladdin. My favorite Disney movie as a kid was Aladdin. In Haman, we are going to get our main villain. All right, our main villain is Haman. So let's read about Haman. This is Esther chapter 3, verses 1 through 2. After these events, King Xerxes honored Haman, son of Hammedatha the Agagite, elevating him and giving him a seat of honor higher than that of all the other nobles. All the royal officials at the king's gate knelt down and paid honor for Haman, for the king had commanded this concerning him. But Mordecai, we're going to meet Mordecai soon, would not kneel down or pay him honor. So Haman, what do we know about Haman? He's second in command. Basically, this position he gets elevated to would be similar to like a prime minister, in essence, is kind of what he is. So he's second in command, and he loves power. All right, people do not seem to like him. Why? Because the king had to command people to kneel down to Haman. This was usually a respect or honor that was just given. It didn't need to be commanded. Somebody in a noble position like this would just get that respect. But the fact that the king had to command it shows that maybe Haman wasn't terribly well thought of. Now also, he has a bloodline that traces back. So it calls him an Agagite. Okay, real quick, here we go. Agag, this is where we get Agagite. King Agag was a ruler of the Amalekites back in about 1 Samuel. Okay, so we have the Amalekites. They're people that don't fear the Lord. Fight against them. Well, King Saul is commanded by God back in 1 Samuel to wipe out all of the Amalekites, spare nothing, spare no one. Well, he disobeys God, and he actually spares Agag. So Agag is an Amalekite that's spared by Saul and let go. So now, if we're going to trace Haman to being an Agagite to Agag, it kind of sets up this whole, he has no regard for God's people. He has a disdain for them, just like Agag and the Amalekites do. That's going to be important coming up. Right? So we can kind of trace his ancestry that way. But let's learn a little more, even about Haman. Esther 3, 8 and 9. Then Haman says to King Xerxes, there is a certain people, the Jews, dispersed among the peoples in all the provinces of your kingdom who keep themselves separate. Their customs are different from those of all other people, and they do not obey the king's laws. It's not in the king's best interest to tolerate them. If it pleases the king, let a decree be issued to destroy them, and I will give 10,000 talents of silver to the king's administrators for the royal treasury. Two things here. He's a man of wealth. The amount of money he offers is 10,000 talents is a large sum. So we know he's already got some money, right? So he loves power. He's in control. He's already got money. And he's not afraid to lie or do whatever it takes to get his way. He is basically, he's kind of truth, half-truth, lie about this whole situation with the Jews. Because, yes, the Jews had their own laws and regulations, but we see no evidence that they were outrightly disobeying or defying the king. But he's telling him, hey, they're doing this, so we need to do something about them. He's not afraid to do whatever it takes to get what he wants. And finally, what do we learn about Haman? Esther 5, 10b through 11. Calling together his friends and Zeresh, his wife, Haman boasted to them about his vast wealth, his many sons, and all the ways the king had honored him and how he elevated him above all the other nobles and officials. Now, this is like two chapters later after he's been promoted. So everybody knows he's been promoted. But he's like, hey, Guess what, everybody? Remember, I'm awesome. I have a lot of money. I'm in superpower, and the king loves me. So he's a gloater. Sounds like our friend Jafar. Jafar wants all the power. He wants to take over the Sultan. He cared about nobody but himself, except for maybe the little bird Iago that sits with him all the time. But the only person Jafar cared about. Jafar was the supervillain. That's kind of what we've created in Haman here, is our big villain. All right, so he's second in command, loves power, disdain for the Jews, because we can trace that back with his lineage. He's wealthy, he's boastful, and he only cares about advancing himself. Sounds like a great villain to me. Who are we casting? Ed Norton. I think Ed Norton can play just about any role ever. I've seen him in a bunch. And for some reason, just his kind of face, he looks a little weaselly sometimes. I feel like that would be Haman. So I went with Ed Norton. So those are kind of our two, in Xerxes and Haman, our two either our villain or antagonist, kind of the guys we're not sure if we really like. But there are good. There is good characters in this story. So let's meet our first one. It is Mordecai. Who do I have for Mordecai? The Ice Guy. The Ice Guy. Kristoff from Frozen. Great classic kids movie, a little newer than the rest. Kristoff, so how is Mordecai, or who is Mordecai, and how is he like Kristoff? Let's find out. Esther 2, verses 5 through 6. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. All right, so what do we learn about Mordecai? First off, he is an exiled Jew that remained in Persia. We talked last week that there were a number of Jews that were still in Susa. So we had the Babylonian exile. So the Jews are exiled out of Jerusalem. Now that's over, they're allowed to return, but some did not. Mordecai is one of those. So he's still hanging out in Persia. And he is also, we're going to talk about his family line. And he is in the family line of Kish, which relates him to King Saul. Okay, so Kish was Saul's father. All right, so if we remember, Saul was commanded by God to kill Agag, and he doesn't do it. Haman related to Agag. Saul didn't do it. Saul in the line of Kish. Mordecai in the line of Kish. So we kind of have this potential conflict whether these guys really know it or not. But in the story, we can see, oh, there's some history there. Maybe we got some unfinished business. Spoiler alert, we do. Next week, you want to be here. That's when that happens, okay? So we trace that family line there. Let's see a little more about Mordecai. Esther 2, verse 7. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, here's our namesake, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So Esther, kind of our main character who we're going to meet next, but with the book obviously being called Esther, Mordecai is her cousin, but raised her when her father and mother die. So he takes care of her, he shows some influence, and we're going to see the influence he's already had and his continued influence in Esther's life as we continue. Final thing to know, Esther 2, 21 through 23. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officers who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this is recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. What do we learn? First off, don't conspire to kill the king, because you get impaled. Not a good way to go. First thing we can learn. Second, what do we learn about Mordecai? So he hears about this plot. He's hanging out at the palace gates, and he hears about this plot to assassinate Xerxes. He doesn't keep that to himself. He gives it away. He's looking out for the king, and in turn looking out for Esther, okay? Because Esther's in the king's palace at this time. How is that like our friend Kristoff? Kristoff looks out for everybody. Kristoff looked out for Sven. First off, Sven the reindeer. I cannot talk about Frozen without talking about Sven. And he looks out for Anna. He's going to let Anna go back to that evil Prince Hans, all right? But he looks out for, he knows it might be best. So Kristoff looks out for others. Mordecai looks out for others. He raised Esther and continues to look after her, reveals the plot to kill the king. All right, so Mordecai, he's in the family line of King Saul. He raises Esther, and he looks out for others. He's kind of our first hero, good guy. Let's like him. Sam, who plays him? Mark Wahlberg. Everybody's laughing in the room, for those of you at home that don't know that. I love me some Mark Wahlberg. I was once told that I kind of looked like him. I don't believe it, but I took it as the biggest compliment I've ever gotten in my life, that I looked like Marky Mark. Mark Wahlberg is going to play Mordecai, our big hero. Mark Wahlberg in, like, Shooter. That's kind of the character I see. If you haven't seen it, watch it. So Mark Wahlberg is going to play Mordecai. So we've had Mordecai, our first hero, our first good guy. But the book is called Esther. Is there a person named Esther? Yes, there is. And we're going to meet her, our big hero. Awesome. Who is Esther like in the Disney world, Sam? Mulan. Mulan. Great old Disney movie. I like the music there also. I have not seen the remake, the live action. If any of you have, I haven't either. Okay. But Mulan. So let's figure out a little bit about Esther. We're also going to carry on the storyline. That's what I want to do first. So we ended last week. Vashti has been banished. So it sets up we need a new queen in the story. So this would come really from Esther 2, 8 through 18. I didn't put it all up there. I'm going to kind of give you the highlights, okay? King Xerxes needs a new queen. So what does he do? He basically has a bunch of young women from the area brought in. Not sure how much with their will, against their will this is, but they're all brought in basically to see who does Xerxes want as his wife. Esther is one. As we heard earlier, she's very beautiful, she's attractive, she's young, so she gets brought in. The first thing that happens is Esther impresses a guy named Haggai. Now, Haggai is a eunuch, works for King Xerxes, but he's in charge of Xerxes' harem. So this is important. She's already impressed the guy that's kind of got this pipeline right to Xerxes. All right, so she impresses him. So then what's going to happen is each woman gets a chance to go before Xerxes and try to impress him and show off. Now, prior to this happening, they get 12 months of beauty treatments. So they go through 12 months, a full year of being done up, getting ready to go, before they have one shot to go before Xerxes, and they are allowed to bring in anything they want, clothes, jewels, whatever, anything they want to try to impress Xerxes. So Esther's turn comes in the story, and what happens is you can probably guess, because we have a book called Esther, she impresses Xerxes. She gains more approval than anybody else. He finds her more beautiful than anybody else. He's like, that's it. She is going to become my queen. What's he do? In classic Xerxes fashion, we have another rager. We have a big party. Because that's what he does. All right, so Esther is now queen. All right, so what do we know about Esther? What can we learn? First off, when we read about Mordecai, we saw the name Hadassah. So that is actually Esther's Jewish name, which means, Hadassah means myrtle. And what a myrtle would be symbolic of at this point would be replacing the briars and thorns in the desert. So taking off something that might be ugly or painful or rough, and replacing it. So that's what her name would mean. Esther, in terms of the Persian language, we think means star, is probably what we think that means there. And she's a very, very beautiful, attractive queen now. So we have Queen Esther. But there are two other things that I think we learn about from Esther, and we're going to look at two verses to see these. It's going to be Esther 2:10 and Esther 2:15. So let's look at 2:10. It says, Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. That's 1. That's 2:10. 2:15. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, that chief eunuch, the king's eunuch who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. I think we see some wisdom and some cunning from Esther in these two verses. Right? Kind of this wisdom, because she doesn't reveal being Jewish. Mordecai instructs her not to. Why? Well, it's entirely possible that Xerxes isn't going to pick a Jewish woman to be queen. We don't know. Maybe she could be in danger for being Jewish. Now, it's important to hear she didn't reveal it. Some will say, well, she lied about it. We don't know that, because it doesn't say she was asked. She just didn't reveal it here at the advice of Mordecai. So she's smart enough to think, hey, this guy's brought me up. He knows. I'm going to listen. But then the cunning, and I like this part. In 15, when she says she took nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, suggested, she's like, huh, I could pick a bunch of stuff, but I don't know Xerxes. But here's this dude that's in charge of all the harem, pipeline right to Xerxes. What does he think I should take in? So she's smart. She goes to him and like, what should I take? And that's what she takes in. And then she wins whatever we're going to call this competition or whatever it might be to become the queen. Mulan. Mulan concealed her identity. All right, she was a woman but couldn't be in the military as a woman, so played herself off to be a man. she had to impress the military leaders. All right, there's the big song early on in the movie, I'll Make a Man Out of You, where she's about to get sent home, but then starts doing a lot better in training, so she gets to stick around. She impresses people. She knows what she has to do to be able to stay and be in a good position. Esther conceals her identity, impresses Haggai and the king, and now we have her as queen. So she's got wisdom, and she's cunning. She thinks through her situation. No rash decision-making here from Esther. So this is the big one. Who am I casting? Who's getting the Oscar nod in the film? I am casting to play Esther Sam. Natalie Portman. Full disclosure, I saw Star Wars Episode 2 as a sophomore in high school with the tennis team, and we all developed incredible crushes on Natalie Portman. So we have Natalie Portman is going to play Esther. So to recap, Pacino plays Xerxes, Ed Norton plays Haman, Mark Wahlberg plays Mordecai, Natalie Portman plays Esther. That's going to be a great film. I'm sure we could get them all together without a problem. So we've met our main characters of the story, right? We know a little bit about them, we see them, but as we talked about, where is God? Because remember, God's character is in the characters of your story, and God's character is in the characters in Esther. So let's look at those. First off, where is God? He's in the unlikely, and he's in the villains. He's in Xerxes and Haman. You might be like, how? How is God evident in Xerxes? Xerxes doesn't know God. He doesn't live the way God would want. He's throwing parties. He's prideful. He's arrogant. He seems like the opposite of God. And Haman. Haman opposes God's people. He's willing to kill them, and we're going to hear more about that. How can God's character be in these people? Well, it's because God shows love and forgiveness. We look at Jesus. Jesus hung out with tax collectors and sinners, people that were probably prideful and loved money and maybe even arrogant. Sounds a lot like Xerxes. I don't know that Jesus would have gone right up to Xerxes' palace and hung out with him there, but that type of dude is who I think Jesus would have spent time with and shown love to and shown forgiveness to. But what about those people that oppose God, that want to kill or arrest? Well, we went through Ephesians this summer at Hometown, written by Paul, but back when Paul was Saul, Saul was one of the biggest persecutors of Christians. But God still called him later on. God called Paul, even though he's the biggest persecutor of Christians that we might have known at that time. God can forgive and love even though those that persecute Christians or hate Christians. Matthew 5, 44, 45 says, "But I tell you, love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you, that you may be children of your Father in heaven. He causes his sun to rise on the evil and the good and sends rain on the righteous and the unrighteous." That's a direct teaching from Jesus in Matthew. Love your enemies and pray for those who persecute you. So God can be in those villains. I had college friends that I wouldn't call villains, but were people that didn't follow God at all. All right, they were still friends of mine, but they didn't follow God. They didn't act like God would have them act. But do I think God can still forgive them and love them? Yes. I had a couple friends that were kind of the outright in-your-face atheist kind of people that anytime something would come up and I would reference my faith as to why I believed something, they would come back and challenge me on it. And I will be honest, I was not at all prepared for those conversations, and they knocked me down with those. But I think God can still get a hold of them, even if they're outrightly defiant of God. So God's character is in the unlikely and in the villains and in the sinners. But there's good news, because God is also in the heroes, right? He's in the heroes and in the likely candidates. So how is he in those? Mordecai and Esther. Now, some people actually, as they read through Esther, will make the case that Mordecai and Esther aren't really that great of examples. They would say that they don't show good characteristics of God because Mordecai, they'll call Mordecai selfish and say he's only thinking of himself. They'll say Esther did lie when she didn't realize she was Jewish. She shouldn't have married Xerxes. And they'll say the reason that God is silent in this book is because he disapproves. Now, I can see where they're coming from, but I don't agree personally. When I read this, I see it differently. All right? I see it as an opposite approach. I think their actions show God's timing in this story and show that God is moving behind the scenes, like we titled this series. So Mordecai, I think Mordecai is working for a bigger purpose than his own. He raises Esther. It doesn't say that he had to, all right? He probably didn't, but her father and mother died. She's family, so he raises her. He thinks about her. She needs somebody. He foils the plot against Xerxes. He's like, wow, this king could be killed. That's not right. So he foils it. And we're going to see as we go in the next coming weeks how he's going to work for the Jewish people. Jesus worked for a purpose greater than himself. Jesus' life on earth was for a purpose greater than his own. It was to save us from our sins. He had chances to make his life better on his own. Right, when he goes out in Matthew 4 and is tempted in the wilderness, he's offered everything. but he turns it down. When he's in the garden, he asks God, take the cup from me if it's your will, but it doesn't happen because his purpose is far greater. So we see those traits in Mordecai. So we can see Mordecai like that. But what about our big heroine in Esther? All right, we see it in her wisdom. Where there is strife, there is pride, but wisdom is found in those who take advice. That's Proverbs 13:10. Esther shows this wisdom, as we talked about earlier, in concealing her identity, like Mordecai suggested, and listening to Haggai. She showed some wisdom. She took the advice of others and showed that godly wisdom. We also see God in her name, all right, in the Jewish name Adasa. We talked about earlier it was the symbol of replacing the thorns and the briars in the desert. Well, that depicts the forgiveness that God offers when he takes away the thorns and the briars in our own lives and replaces it with his love. That's in her name, with it meaning myrtle. And it's in how she's going to have to handle a position in the palace. She's going to be royalty, all right? We know she is queen. We know, we read this teaser last week, she's going to potentially risk her life for her people. And if you're going to risk it, it means you have the opportunity to die. And we can make a correlation there to Jesus, who risked his life and did die for us. Tim Keller, who's the pastor and author out in New York, wrote a book, and he writes a lot about relating the rest of the Bible to the gospel message and to Jesus. And he says this about Esther, relates Jesus and Esther. Jesus is the true and better Esther, who didn't just risk losing an earthly palace, but lost the ultimate heavenly one, who didn't just risk his life, but gave his life to save people. Jesus' purpose was bigger. And so was Esther. She put herself on the line for people, her people, for God's people. Esther does that. Jesus did that, and he went so far as to die. So we can see Jesus and Esther in a little bit of relation. So God's character shows up in the character of this story, in Xerxes, in Haman, in Mordecai, in Esther. But what about your story? Who are the characters in your story? Your friends, your family, your coworkers, your neighbors. Who is that? Maybe those main characters, the ones that you're tight with a lot. Or that supporting cast, the ones that are maybe on the periphery. Where can you see God's character in those characters? Who are the ones that are maybe the Xerxes that don't know God yet? And then who are the ones that do, that are the Mordecais or the Esthers that God's already gotten a hold of and you can really see them outwardly working with God? And I think it's important to have both. We want both of those in our lives. To people that we're still seeing God work in, or that we want to see God work in, and the ones that God's already gotten a hold of. So we want to see both of those in our lives. Look for the character of God in the characters of your life, of your story. Let's pray. God, we thank you for today, that we could come before you again, that we can continue to dive in to the story of Esther, God, and just meet the characters, God, and to see you working behind the scenes, to be working in these characters, God. And God, I pray that we would look for you in the characters of our own story, in the people we're around every day, in the people we're around just once a week, God. I pray that you would show yourself through those characters, God. We pray that in your name. Amen.